It's up!
Welcome to the Young Turks on a interesting, well, let's hope auspicious day.
It's a super day.
It is indeed. It's got super in the title. Super Tuesday, guys. So if you haven't voted, go out there and vote for whoever you're gonna vote for. The polls do close in about an hour in some states. And of course, throughout the night as we go, we'll have special Super Tuesday coverage for you guys. Democrats first, Republicans second. So stay in here for that. And we've got some news on that as well, because apparently some people have decided they're not voting for Nikki Haley for curious reasons. You're gonna wanna see that. And we have fairly significant political news to begin with.
Yes, a big story that should be relevant to progressives who've got a bone to pick with this woman. Let's get right to it.
I love Arizona, and I am so proud of what we've delivered. Because I choose civility, understanding, listening, working together to get stuff done, I will lead the Senate at the end of this year.
Allow me to put my jank Uyghur hat on to say, down goes cinema, down goes cinema. Let's go to jank for more.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we got her. Down goes cinema, down goes cinema. All right, guys, by the way, now Manchin and cinema are both gone.
Bye.
Because they preferred civility? No, they preferred corporate cash.
See you later.
And the reason why this is such a huge story today is because for the first time in American politics, pleasuring corporate donors has not worked.
We won't miss you.
Yeah, they're both goners. They both serve their donors 100%. Kristen Sinema killed lower drug prices and higher taxes on corporations and the wealthy. She was the most corporate politician of my lifetime, pretending to be a progressive in the beginning, then did a switcheroo, the original Fetterman, and then represented corporate donors better than anyone in the Senate. And guess what? It turns out voters aren't buying that crap anymore. So see you, wouldn't want to be you.
Yes, politicians be lying, sometimes there's consequences. Now the Arizona senator has not only announced her retirement today, this also means that Ruben Gallego and Carrie Lake are left to brawl it out for her seat. So we'll see how that plays out. We did just show you a clip of her announcement video. In that same video, Sinema really wanted to make it clear that she felt that it was wrong, that she wasn't appreciated as much as she deserved to be. So let's take a look at that portion of her announcement.
Through listening, understanding, and compromise, we delivered tangible results that make America safer, stronger, and more prosperous. Yet, despite modernizing our infrastructure, ensuring clean water, delivering good jobs and safer communities, Americans still choose to retreat farther to their partisan corners. These solutions are considered failures, either because they're too much or not nearly enough. It's all or nothing.
I mean, why aren't my constituents rewarding me for fighting super hard to pass bills that would give massive federal grants to private corporations to either build our infrastructure or privatize some of our public infrastructure? Why aren't they thanking me for that, Cenk?
Yeah. So what she's doing there is classic, establishment Democrats, establishment Republicans, and establishment media my whole lifetime, which is, well, look, there's these two radical extremes, and I was the one that was reasonable in the middle. That's why I was for protecting the private equity loophole. Wait, what?
Yeah.
The private equity loophole is a total crime. It lowers taxes on the richest people in the country totally unjustifiably, treats their income as investments, as coming from investments, when it isn't. It's just straight income. It's flat out cheating on behalf of very literally the richest people in the world. Okay? So, and how does that poll among Republicans and Democrats? Terribly, terribly. All Republicans, all Democrats hate it. It is not at all a moderate position. She's in favor of not being able to negotiate drug prices for Medicare and for the government, which means she's against capitalism, polls terribly among Republican voters, and she's for higher drug prices just so that the drug companies can make more excessive profits off of all of us. Polls terribly, terribly, not anywhere near moderate. But my whole life, everyone in Washington, including the media, would play along with this game. Well, the moderate Kristen Sinema is, you know, and they, to this day, as she's retiring, they're like, the moderate Kristen Sinema.
Yeah.
No, she's corporate Kristen Sinema. She has nothing to do with moderate positions at all. In fact, she's the one that killed enormously moderate positions like paid family leave, higher minimum wage, etc.
I just take offense to her framing in that announcement video because, you know, the other trick that I've seen from corporatist politicians is how they'll jump to arguments uplifting the idea of civility and basically like looking down at so-called extremists or partisans. What they're really referring to here is anyone on either side of the political spectrum that has a problem with policies that are specifically meant to funnel money from taxpaying citizens to corporations that already get all sorts of benefits, tax cuts, loopholes, deductions within our economic system that ordinary working Americans don't get to take advantage of. Look, my problem with the infrastructure bill was the fact that it allowed for huge portions of our public infrastructure, our public lands, to be passed to corporations to essentially manage. And that means that certain roads that you are currently using for free will be managed and maintained by corporations, which will do what? They're going to implement a toll or a fee in order to use that infrastructure. That, by the way, your taxpayer money had already paid for building in the first place. And so, like, I have a huge problem with the framing of that kind of legislation. But on top of that, listen, I do think there's a problem with the inability of both sides, some portions of both sides of the political spectrum, having this inability to speak to one another and still respect each other if they disagree on policy. But that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is the vast majority of Americans who are sick of crony capitalism and also the corporatist policies coming out from, you know, Congress, which is dominated, unfortunately, by politicians like Kyrsten Sinema, who likes to present herself as the civil one, when in reality it's not about civility, it's about funneling money from, you know, the working class to the corporations.
Look, if you just look at the how they line up in terms of polling and their policy positions, for almost all the corporate Democrats and Republicans, they're actually complete radicals. The American people don't like any of their positions. The populists are the ones that actually have popular positions. But what does the media and the establishment do in every regard? They paint the moderate people as the radicals and the radical corporatists as the moderates.
Right.
So I love that she's gone. There was nothing moderate about her, nothing civil. All she did was sell you out. So what's gonna happen next? There's two last things. One is, how does it affect the Senate race in Arizona? Well, she believes, and she said this in a speech recently, that she was gonna take about 10 to 20% of the vote away from the Democratic candidate and about 25 to 35% away from the Republican candidate, that's Carrie Lake. So when she drops out, according to her own calculation, she's helping deliver more votes to Carrie Lake and the Republicans.
Oh, that's interesting, because the reporting today following her announcement argued that the Democratic Party is like breathing a sigh of relief.
Yeah, it's just a lot of the reporters that cover politics don't know anything about politics. Okay, and the last thing is, where is she gonna go?
Lobbyist?
Most obvious thing in the world.
Consultant?
Yeah. Either lobbyist or more likely some sort of vague consultant, which is actually just means lobbyist slash we're paying you off for the favors you did for us. Very likely she'll wind up on with a firm on Wall Street, because there's no one she helped more than the private equity and hedge fund guys who got to commit trillions of dollars of robbery thanks to her. So they'll reward her with several million dollars a year for basically doing nothing, and she'll live happily ever after. So that's the downside of this story.
I mean, to be fair, the corporate world was already rewarding her with millions of dollars to do nothing in Congress. So now she's gonna be doing it outside of Congress, but influencing Congress through her lobbying. I wanted to give you some more information about the corporate money that flew into her campaign coffers throughout her political career. So Let me just note that she did in fact do exactly what we're seeing with Fetterman happen in real time. The woman, now known as a committed centrist, ran for the Arizona legislature nearly two decades ago as a Green Party activist. Protested the Iraq war with Code Pink, the left-wing social justice movement. And once warned of the dangers of capitalism and the almighty dollar, which apparently was just too seductive for her to turn down. So let's take a look at the money. So Forbes had reported that from 2016 to 2021, Kyrsten Sinema received donations from 59 billionaires and six spouses of billionaires. But all but one of them were located outside of Arizona. So you have billionaires from outside of her state giving her money to do what as a United States senator? To pass legislation that benefits the corporate world in America, even if it's to the detriment of her constituents in the state of Arizona. And that's probably the reason why polling showed that she was consistently coming out at third place in the Senate race. So that's, in my opinion, a big reason why she's stepping down or not seeking re-election. She's also taken more than $850,000 from the pharmaceutical industry, and that's a huge reason why she was not in favor of allowing our Medicare system to negotiate drug prices. This is not price fixing, it's simply allowing for Medicare, which we fund through our taxes, to negotiate for lower drug prices. So our Medicare system isn't getting ripped off by the pharmaceutical companies, but she was one of the obstacles in passing that type of regulation and allowing for those negotiations to take place. So, sayonara, we won't miss you, and I hope I never hear from her again.
Yes, and understand that every article that calls her centrist or moderate is lying to you. Yeah. Probably not on purpose. These reporters live in their own completely detached from reality bubble, where they think that if you serve corporate interests and further radical ideas that the American people hate, that you are a moderate or centrist. So I'm thrilled that she has exited the building. Good riddance, and we hope to never see you again.
Well, let's move on to some international news with an update on a story that we covered in Gaza several weeks ago. New audio from a December IDF operation in the Gaza Strip captured Israeli hostages literally begging for help just days before Israeli forces had mistook them for Hamas fighters and tragically and fatally shot them. Now, in the recording that was released by Israel's Khan News on Sunday, 26-year-old Alon Shamriz, and 28-year-old Yotam Haim, who were being held hostage by Hamas, along with a 22-year-old by the name of Samir Talalka, can be heard shouting in an attempt to alert the IDF soldiers to their presence. So this story is just so tragic, and now we have some audio as a result of a canine that the IDF was using. The canine had a GoPro attached to it, and they speak in Hebrew, but we'll tell you what they're yelling out after you hear this recording. So the words the men are shouting in between the gunfire reads as follows. So we're translating here, and it might not be perfect, but they're saying, "Help, we are by the stairs, under the stairs, under the stairs, please help, hostages," and then they say their names, "Help." So they identify themselves and they're hoping that the IDF soldiers will come in and help them. But the IDF soldiers were under the impression that they were really Hamas militants seeking to trick them, and they, as a result, did not end up saving them. They actually did the opposite. The most damning part of this whole incident is that soldiers had heard shouting of help and hostages in Hebrew from the building, but they believed it was an attempt by Hamas to lure them into an ambush, according to an IDF probe. They found signs left by hostages trying to get soldiers' attention, also dismissed as part of a ploy. Now, they heard the hostages' cries with their own ears. They didn't help. And the recording was picked up by a GoPro camera mounted on a dog from the military's canine unit. This is super tragic as well. The dog was then sent into the Gaza City building during the gun battle. The dog was killed allegedly by Hamas terrorists, and the camera was recovered days later, which is why we have this audio now. But by then, IDF troops had already killed the three escaped hostages, which is also an incredible part of the story. They were able to escape their captors, and they unfortunately didn't make it out alive, even after being able to do that. So let's take a look at the individuals who lost their lives as a result of the IDF mistaking them as threats. And back in December, days after the young men were killed, Shamriz's father, Avi Shamriz, spoke out saying the following, quote, "The IDF abandoned my son on October 7th and the IDF murdered my son on December 14th. That's what happened." It's just really heartbreaking.
That's of course an Israeli citizen saying that. Two interesting parts of the story. Number one, Israel right now is at -1 hostages recovered by the IDF. They have recovered three and killed four.
Through their military operations.
Yeah, through their military operations. And those are only the four we know of, because a lot more might have died through the bombings. The massive indiscriminate bombing they did of buildings that might have contained hostages. So, but as far as we know, they have rescued -1 hostages. That is unbelievable. And to this day, all the Israeli defenders say their main goal is to, they have to keep going. They have to keep killing more Palestinians because they're trying so hard to rescue hostages. Are they? Because it certainly doesn't look like it. I don't think they're trying to rescue hostages at all. It looks a lot more like they're trying to indiscriminately kill anyone inside Gaza. So now they haven't killed everyone. Yes, they can. Congratulations, Israeli supporters. Yeah, they haven't used a nuke yet to kill every single person. They literally brag about that these days. That's a talking point for them. Well, we could have killed them all. We didn't kill every single one of them.
Right.
Well, congratulations. Wow. You sound really humanitarian.
That's how they believe they're debunking allegations of genocide, because their argument is, well, if we wanted to do a genocide by just wiping them all out in one fell swoop, we could do that.
By the way, again, I've used this example 100 times, but literally what the Turks said about the Armenians. They said, well, we didn't kill the ones on the west side of Turkey and in Istanbul and in the big cities. We just killed the ones in the east. See, it's not a genocide. That is just wrong understanding of the word genocide. Holocaust is when you try to kill every single person in that race, okay, or ethnicity or religion. Genocide is when you target a group specifically and kill an enormous number of innocent civilians. And usually has telltale signs like ethnic cleansing, moving people from one direction to another, denying them food, indiscriminate killing of civilians. This is a textbook genocide, what's happening in Gaza right now. So, and what drives me crazy about it and why we covered so much is because it's happening right now, and there's nothing that America is doing about it other than funding it and making it more possible and defending it.
Yeah, I want to elaborate.
It drives me nuts.
I want to elaborate on that a little bit more, because I've been noticing this weird, and it might be bots, because it's a similar point that's being made over and over again, and it doesn't make any sense to me. So supporters of Joe Biden are increasingly frustrated by voters, typically Democratic voters, who see his handling of the war in Gaza as so inhumane that they just can't get themselves to cast a ballot for him, right? And it's not just Arab Americans, although Arab Americans have been the most vocal, certainly in states like Michigan. So Biden supporters, Freudian slip there, are arguing, well, I don't understand. There are far more civilians dying in Ukraine because of what's happening with Russia. Or far more civilians have already died in Ukraine. First of all, I haven't fact checked that, but that's what they're claiming. But guys, the reason why there is a moral issue with Israel versus what's happening in Ukraine is we're not supporting Putin. Right? Like, we're not supporting Putin's invasion into Ukraine or the slaughter of civilians in Ukraine. We're doing the opposite, right? The US government is helping Ukraine defend itself against Putin and his illegal invasion into their sovereign country. When you look at the Israel-Gaza war, it's totally flipped, where right now the side that's carrying out the mass civilian deaths or killings is the side that we're funding and supporting. And just today, John Kirby had a press conference and was asked, okay, well, it's very clear that Israel is continuing the blockade of humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip. And so as a result, has the Biden White House maybe reconsidered the military aid that they want to provide to Israel? And Kirby's like, no, no, we haven't reconsidered.
Of course not.
They need to defend themselves. No, never mind, they have the Iron Dome, they have defense capabilities and military capabilities that Palestinians could only dream of. But you know, that's the argument. They need the weapons, and so no matter what Israel does, even if they're breaking international laws, even if they're committing war crimes, they're our ally, and we are going to prevent the present them with the weapons that they want.
So a couple of things here. Just on a controversial, unacceptable question, and I'll leave it there. So are the Palestinians allowed to defend themselves?
No, apparently not.
Or do they just sit there and get murdered? And but if they ever fight back, it's obviously terrorism. Okay, I hear you on that, and I've accepted that many times. So isn't it terrorism when Israel kills 25, 30 times more civilians? No, no. They're angels, angels. When we murder Palestinian civilians, that's because we're the good guys and had a right to defend ourselves. Nonsense, total garbage. When you kill 25 times the number of people that Hamas killed, you're not defending yourself anymore. You're just murdering people so you can say, aha, now how do you like it? We crushed you and we're gonna occupy you for the rest of your goddamn lives. Oh wow, you guys seem like real humanitarians. Show me when you're gonna end the occupation, you liars. Everyone in the right-wing government of Israel is a bunch of fascist, lying, religious zealots, okay? Did I just call them fascists? Yes, you're goddamn right I did. When you kill this number of civilians and you do it on purpose, and you openly and brazenly talk about how you're gonna move them out of Gaza, how you're gonna take Gaza, how you're gonna just crush the spirit, the soul, the humanity, and the lives of these people, that is exactly what fascists do. Anyway, now to the casualties, by the way, I just looked it up. Wow, this is a big number, it really is. In a little over 2 years and 25 months, 10,582 civilians have been killed in Ukraine. In under 5 months, 20% of the time, Israel has killed over 30,000.
Jesus.
So three times as much, I know, IDF will say, no, seven of those were Hamas. We got, I think maybe we got a couple of Hamas fighters. I mean, bombs, 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 buildings, schools, hospitals, everything. We just destroyed entire Gaza. I think we got a couple of Hamas guys. Yeah. So you did three times as bad as the Russians when they invaded Ukraine, and you did it in 5 months as opposed to 25 months. So look, you see somebody defending Israel online, on Twitter especially, there's an enormous chance that it's an IDF troll or bot. Okay, yeah, there's some real people, but like 90% of them all repeat the same talking points. We've seen this movie 1,000 times. Last thing, most important story about the hostages is it shows you what the rules of engagement are in Gaza for the IDF. That is what military officers tell their soldiers. Hey, how do you handle a situation? If someone's coming up to you, what do you do? Etc., right? And obviously what they've told them is, don't even look for half a second. If they are males, let alone the females, let alone the children, right? And now, you know, tens of thousands of women and children have been killed. But if you see a male, don't look twice, shoot, kill, murder. Murder, 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 murder. Oh no, it was Israelis, their lives matter. When we killed 10, 20, 100, 200 times, 2,000 times as many Palestinians, no one even cared. Palestinian men, who cares? They're all terrorists. Oh no, it was an Israeli. Their lives are a billion times more valuable than Palestinians. Oh no! If it was Palestinians, they probably would have celebrated that night. You think they wouldn't have partied that night if it was Palestinians? So don't tell me that your rules of engagement are to protect civilians. That's a joke, it's a horrific, tragic joke. The IDF's rules of engagement is do terrorism.
Kenneth Cheeseborough makes a return here at TYT when we come back from the break. And who doesn't want to hear some updates about the Cheeseborough? I know I do. Come right back.
Back on TYT, Cenk, Anna, and all of these wonderful people. First of all, Peachy Keen, thank you for joining. They hit the join button below. We need it. We appreciate it. Another handle that just joined is On Vacation at Turks Anna Jankos. That's hilarious. Turks and Caicos twist on our names.
I mean, I hope you're actually on vacation at Turks and Caicos. That would be amazing.
That would be awesome. And then these people who gifted membership, Exu Lula Lamas gifted one, and Branko. And Bronco gifted 5, BH gifted 10, and the legend Benjamin Gilbert Liff gifted another 100. And Benjamin, I'll read your super chat in the next break. Anna.
Well, we've got an update on the attempts at overturning the 2020 election. Some newly disclosed messages between Trump lawyers and others within the Trump campaign. So let's get right to it.
Cheeseborough might be the only one who actually showed up to the US Capitol on January 6th. These text messages include selfies where he took selfies with conspiracy theorist Alex Jones at the US Capitol on the same day that the riot happened. And look, he even bragged at one point about being able to whiff tear gas that was fired at protesters in the US Capitol on that day, kind of highlighting his proximity to the action that was going on.
Wow, how fun. Kenneth Cheeseborough, the Trump campaign lawyer at the center of the fake elector scheme to overturn the 2020 presidential election, just kept scheming even after the Capitol riots that occurred on January 6th. Now, Cheeseborough pleaded guilty in the Georgia election interference case and is cooperating with prosecutors as part of a plea deal. He has also been identified by CNN as one of the unindicted co-conspirators in the federal case on election interference. Now, going back to the claims in regard to Cheeseborough continuing to plot and scheme even after the riots of January 6th. We know about this thanks to new texts and emails that have been made public as part of a lawsuit. Now, the new materials were disclosed after Cheeseborough and former Trump lawyer Jim Tropas, who are both from Wisconsin, settled a lawsuit that was brought by Wisconsin's real Democratic electors from 2020. And so this tranche of emails, texts, and photos offers, you know, some more context and also additional evidence that Cheeseborough was the one who was pushing for the electors' plot to move forward, regardless of where Trump stood on some of the litigation and the lawsuits challenging the election results. And as we've reported incessantly on the show, he failed in those lawsuits, in all dozens of them. And so Cheeseborough pushed a more aggressive version of the fake electors plot from a secret Twitter account than he later described in his interview with investigators in Michigan. Cheeseborough told Trump lawyer Jim Tropas in late 2020 that it was really not necessary to link the GOP electors to ongoing litigation. Having the electors send in alternate slates of votes on December 14th can pay huge dividends, even if there is no litigation pending on January 6th, he said in an email. Weeks later, Cheeseborough protested outside of the Capitol and even, you know, posed with a Alex Jones in the background while Congress certified the election results. This is on January 6th, of course. Previously unseen pictures made public Monday include a selfie that Cheeseborough took near the Capitol with Jones in the background. And as you heard in that CNN clip, he also texted Tropas and said that he caught a whiff of the tear gas deployed against pro-Trump rioters. And there's the photo again, you can see Alex Jones in the background. So he kept plotting after the riots. I think that's an interesting part of these newly disclosed messages. The texts show that even after January 6th, Cheeseborough continued pitching ideas to Tropas for how the election could be overturned through long shot lawsuits. According to the text chain, he told the lawyer that on January 8th, 2021, quote, the events of the last 2 days open up legal options in the states for winning rulings favorable to Trump. So he was undeterred. He kept going, kept plotting, kept scheming. It didn't work out too well for him. And so that's part of the reason why he got indicted in the Georgia case. So I've got more to share with you, including what Trump definitely knew as a result of these messages. But what do you think so far?
So first of all, so Cheesebro is an important character, and I don't care how he pronounces his name, because he's the one that came up with the idea for January 6th. But remember, the idea for January 6th wasn't just storm the building, take the building, and now we have Congress, because that's not a plan. No, he came up with the actual plan, he wrote the memo, and he said, all the way back in December 14th, and I read the original memo, he said January 6th is going to be the day that we should act. But in order for us to act then, we have to now set up these alternate electors. He acknowledges in the memo that it is a very controversial idea. Now, if it's not a controversial idea, you wouldn't have to say that, right? Like if it was a perfectly normal idea. And in fact, in one part of the memo, he talks about messaging is really important here, because we have to say that this is normal when it is not normal, and he knows that, and that's why he's saying that. Let's make sure to pretend that what we're doing is a regular occurrence, even though it definitely isn't, okay?
So in one memo in early December that Troop has claimed he sent directly to the White House, according to the newly released messages, it starts off with basically, Chesebro sending a message saying, Jim, referring to Jim Clark, that's one of the other lawyers, Jim, can you send my December 6th memo to Trump lawyer Justin Clark, messaging on January 6th being the real key date is key, Chesebro wrote to Troopis on December 7th of 2020. And then he responds by saying, I have sent it to the White House this afternoon, the real decision makers, Troopis responded, though he didn't identify who at the White House received the memo. I also gave it to Reince, meaning Reince Priebus, so he might talk with the president. And at that time, Reince Priebus was the former chief of staff for Trump.
Yeah, so what is kosher and what's not kosher? What's kosher is suing, saying, hey, I have evidence that I actually won the election. There's nothing wrong with that. Asking for a recount, nothing wrong with that. Asking for a hand recount, no problems. Not only do I think there's no problems, I like those things. It helps verify the vote. I would ask for it as a progressive, I would ask for it as anyone, okay? That helps protect our system. What is not kosher is, hey, it looks like we're gonna lose all the cases. And even if we do, meaning that we have no evidence and we definitely lost the election, what we should do is have alternate electors that the people did not vote for, but those are Trump electors. And by the way, in the memo, it also talks about if the actual Trump electors, because they have slate of electors ready to go, if the slate of electors can't show up for some reason, wink, maybe we put in other trusted Republicans to be the fake electors. So understand the January 6th plot. So he explains in the memo, what we do is whether there's actually case or not, it doesn't matter. All we gotta do is get Pence to not certify the election and to say, I am not only certifying, but I am counting myself. And instead of counting the actual electors, I'm going to count the fake electors.
Which Chesebro in memos referred to as fake or fraudulent electors.
In at least one memo.
Yeah.
Okay. And so then if Pence does that, great. Because then it's gonna go to, Democrats are gonna be forced to say, wait a minute, no, Trump didn't win, and go to the courts. And he said, what you want the courts to do is kick it back to Congress, go, hey, this is a political question, I ain't got nothing to do with it. And when it goes back to Congress, the House votes by state, and the Republicans have more states in the House of Representatives than the Democrats do. That way we win, even if we didn't win. So now he doesn't write the part where he says even if we didn't win, but he writes everything else. And so he makes it super clear, this is a little controversial and you have to pretend that this is normal, but this is how we would win the election, wink, when you really didn't. So he's the guy who came up with the plan. And I think that, you know, he cooperated with some of the prosecutors. I hope he does some jail time anyway. And I hope that they got enough evidence from him to actually convict Trump, who's the one who authorized this plan, because this was a plan against America. It was this, when people talk about Trump is against democracy, this is what they're talking about.
Right. And look, the riots that took place on January 6th, obviously it was shocking and that gets all of the attention. But anyone who's under the impression that this is what the whole they're trying to steal the election argument is about, your mistake, like don't buy that argument. It's not just about the riots. It was the planning and the fake elector scheme that was really the type of plotting that was taking place that could have, if Pence was willing to play ball, overturned the election and essentially resulted in, you know, Trump being president, which is against the will of the American people. So.
Yep. And I'll give the last word to one of our members, tyt.com/join to be part of the show. Jenks Old Speedo. Uh-oh, that's his handle. We have fun with the members. We have fun. Be part of the show. Anyway, he wrote in, I'm starting to think that this cheese bro isn't a Gouda guy.
Oh my God.
Ending on a fun note. Hey, coos. But nevertheless, we have fun with the cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs guys.
Do I have to pretend like that was funny because it's a member?
Are you kidding me? I love that. You really didn't think that was? Oh,
okay,
that's such
fine.
A dad joke.
Gouda's good. Gouda's good. I will allow it.
Is she not merciful?
I will allow it.
Okay.
All right. But your handle, you got to change it. Okay.
Well, I changed it already from he used to be the throat goat dragon.
You're a dirty, dirty boy, aren't you?
All right. That's only going to encourage him. I don't want to see the next handle.
All right. Let's go to break. But before we do, let me give you a little taste of what's to come. We're going to talk a little bit about a pretty damning ruling for Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in regard to his Stop Woke Act. So the courts have weighed in on the constitutionality of the Stop Woke Act. And then later we'll hear from Muslims for Trump. We had Michael Shore go to one of the Trump rallies in Michigan. And believe it or not, there are absolutely some Trump supporters who happen to be Muslims. We're gonna hear from them and try to understand why.
TYT, Cenk, Anna, Eddie, and Donald. Eddie and Donald just joined by hitting the join button below the video on YouTube. Welcome, brothers. And Box gifted another membership in Kroger 47, gifted 5. You guys are amazing. Anna.
Well, let's talk about a federal appeals court really punching Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in the face, figuratively, obviously. A Florida appeals court has blocked Florida Governor Ron DeSantis's so-called Stop Woke Act by upholding a lower court's ruling that found the law violates the constitutional rights of private companies in the state. Fascinating. So before we get to yesterday's ruling, here's a little history on the bill in question and the previous legal battle that it underwent. Now, the Individual Freedom Act, better known as the Stop Woke Act, was one of several bills Republican Governor Ron DeSantis signed in 2022 as part of his war on woke ideology. It was intended to prevent teachings or mandatory workplace activities that suggest a person is privileged or oppressed simply based on their race, sex, color, or national origin. Now, the law prohibiting these types of trainings in workplaces, it prohibits like these types of trainings, like race-based trainings, things like that, DEI trainings in places like private companies, public schools, colleges, and universities. DeSantis has framed this as a tool for employees and students to stand up against discrimination, since some of these seminars or conferences that companies or various institutions have could focus on white individuals in the company, maybe targeting them and arguing that they are privileged, it could make them feel discriminated against. That's the argument that DeSantis and his supporters were making. Now, in a previous statement, DeSantis said, "No one should be instructed to feel as if they are not equal or shamed because of their race. In Florida, we will not let the far left woke agenda take over our schools and workplaces." Now, a federal judge initially blocked the enforcement of certain parts of the law dealing with corporate trainings, and this happened in August of 2022. They said that it discriminates on the basis of viewpoint in violation of the First Amendment. So they cited the First Amendment and free speech rights for the reasoning in blocking it. and is impermissibly vague in violation of the 14th Amendment. Now let's pivot to yesterday's ruling where an appeals court upheld the lower court's ruling. Okay, it was a panel of three judges and they made similar arguments about the First Amendment. And how did this case even come to be? Well, honeyfun.com, an online wedding registry website in Clearwater, argued in court that the law would prevent it from holding an employee seminar about women's advancement in business and institutional racism. Primo, a franchise of Ben & Jerry's ice cream with stores in Clearwater and Tampa, argued that it would be prevented from teaching employees about systemic racism, oppression, and intersectionality. And so the three judge panel of the US Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit ended up ruling that the part pertaining to private companies exceeds the bounds of the First Amendment right to freedom of speech and expression. Judge Britt C. Grant, who was appointed by Trump, wrote the following opinion, stating that by limiting its restrictions to a list of ideas designated as offensive, the act targets speech based on its content. And by barring only speech that endorses any of those ideas, it penalizes certain viewpoints. And the greatest First Amendment sin.
Yeah, it's exactly what I was gonna say. I mean, this is such a core First Amendment violation. The government telling you what you can and can't say. This is so ironic coming from the freedom of speech guys. If you remember the 2020 convention of the Republicans, almost every speech was about, hey man, we got freedom of speech rights here in America, freedom, freedom. And we're allowed to say, because at the time they were saying all sorts of racist and sexist, etc. stuff, and then Trump was saying it, and they wanted to defend their right to say it. So they were pretending that they were in favor of all freedom of speech, when that's not remotely true, especially in the state of Florida. Florida has also passed laws saying that if you disagree with the government of Israel, the government of Florida can punish you.
Similar laws have passed in Texas,
Yeah, that's the most outrageous First Amendment violation, let alone the fact that why are you guys passing laws preventing us from criticizing foreign countries? That's so mental, I can't wrap my head around it. But from the guys who claimed that they were in favor of the First Amendment and freedom of speech. And now DeSantis does it again. Companies, if you want to say something against racism, you're not allowed. So do they have to be pro-racism? Do they have to be pro-sexism? This is a total insanity.
Besides,
like,
which
there are abuses, in my opinion, like of some level of somewhat. Some companies teach their employees about who's at fault, et cetera, et cetera. But we need to have conversations about that. And we need to talk that through without us saying to companies, you're not allowed to say this and you must say that, especially on this topic.
Look, I don't think it's the role of the government to step in and control what kind of trainings private companies should be able to do. So I agree with this ultimate decision, I do. But I also agree that there are some examples of DEI trainings that actually end up being far more toxic for the work environment, as opposed to being helpful to the work environment. And so one example that I've actually talked about on the show before was when the DEI trainer over at Uber ended up getting suspended because she was listening to some of the white female employees there who didn't want to be called Karens by their colleagues at Uber, which is like the most understandable thing ever. That creates a hostile work environment. So she wanted to have a special seminar like meeting to discuss that and hear those employees out. And it led to a huge conflict within the company because she had the audacity of wanting to represent the concerns of some of the employees who happened to be white females. Like, it was
And then she
ridiculous.
Was suspended and punished for daring to have an open and honest conversation about that. But that's for Uber to deal with. That's not for the government to deal
Agreed,
with.
Agreed. Yeah.
And so I think Uber made a terrible decision there. By the way, she wasn't even white. She was Asian. And so she's like, but we should also not discriminate against our white colleagues. And people were like, boo! Now the people who, criticize her so much it led to her suspension. Of course, they don't think that they just want to mindlessly attack white people. They don't think that, right?
But they are.
But they do think I should be able to be be able to call even my coworkers names like Karen.
Right.
If I think that they're, you know,
they're making a big deal out of something that they shouldn't.
Right.
Like whatever. Like listen, you should treat everyone around you with as much respect as possible, period. Regardless of their background, nationality, gender, race, like it doesn't matter. Creating a hostile work environment is awful. And it, because one group was historically discriminated against, that doesn't give that group the right to then kind of lash out at their colleagues at work and create a hostile work environment. We all have to deal with each other for many, many hours every single day. Let's try to make it as pleasant as possible.
Look, when the large companies started diversifying, was there racism and sexism?
Totally.
Through the roof, like legendary, epic, horrible discrimination based on race and sex, right? And that continued for a long time. And does it still continue in some companies? Of course. Should you teach people not to discriminate inside companies? Definitely, definitely. No racial or sexual harassment, discrimination should be allowed. But you should not, but you should extend that to white people as well. And I like that's become a controversial thing. Like, no, you shouldn't discriminate against white people. That's nuts. That's not at all controversial. And so like then it's gonna force some people to sue if they think that they were discriminated against for being white.
Oh, that's actually happened already with some public workers. I talked about it when I covered that Uber story. So there have been some successful lawsuits.
And I'm sure that they'll be called racist, et cetera, but guys, I've said this 100 times. The progressive idea is to fight against injustice. It's not to do injustice, okay? So saying everyone should be equal, excellent, perfect. And should black people have 1% less rights? Hell no, no way. Same exact rights, same for women and men, obviously. But if you then turn around and go, well, I want special privileges that to be able to discriminate against white women, white men, that's nuts. That is fighting for injustice. And so, but remember, that's not what DeSantis was doing in this case. DeSantis did a blanket prohibition against companies that was way overbroad.
It was super
that did
vague.
Not allow them to make decisions about how to fight discrimination within the workplace on their own, right? In through the proper channels, and it said it made it seem like you can't even fight discrimination in the workplace. So it was very toxic and it was definitely unconstitutional, and now the courts have agreed.
All right, why don't we do one more story? Maybe we'll wrap up the first hour a little late today. But I want to get to this really fascinating interview that our very own reporter Michael Shore did while speaking to a Trump supporter at a Trump rally in Michigan. Let's get to it.
The Democrats are blackmailing us. It's like, oh, if you don't vote for Biden, Trump will come. So what have Biden done to us?
As a significant voice in the Arab American community, you're telling me you want Joe Biden to lose.
I want him to lose. I don't care about Trump winning, but I want Joe Biden to win because this guy, he's one of all we ask for him is ceasefire. Stop the killing. Stop the killing. How difficult is this? I'm not going to be blackmailed into saying that I'm going to be enable Trump to win. The Democrats did that to themselves.
Now, you might think that what Egyptian American comedian Bassem Youssef just said was wrong or irresponsible given the threat that Trump poses to the country and to Muslims. But many Arab Americans are actually feeling the exact same way he is, including a Trump supporter that a TYT reporter, Michael Shore, spoke to and interviewed in Michigan during a Trump rally. Now, this is from a few weeks ago, but I think what this individual had to say was important to listen to, not because you are likely gonna agree with him, but to understand the argument by Muslim Americans or Arab Americans who might decide to not cast a ballot for the general election at all, or might even switch over to Donald Trump. Let's listen.
I'm from Yemen. Originally, I was born in America, but I'm from Yemen. This is how we dress back then. A lot of the Arabs actually used to support the Democratic Party. And so all the weird shit's been going on.
So he references weird stuff? Like, what weird stuff is going on, you might ask? Well, he explains in this next clip.
Biden's dead. He can't walk. He can't talk. So really, if it was anybody against Biden, I'd vote for them anyway. But I'm a big Donald Trump supporter. He's a great man. He's a gangster. So any of the other countries know, if Trump's in office, they're not acting up. With Biden, he's sleeping. You know, no one. I don't think anyone's really scared of him. Obama and Biden bombed Yemen very heavily, but because Obama said mashallah, he said an Arabic word, people supported him and thought he was with us. He really wasn't. He was bombing. He drone bombed Yemen more than any other president.
So he's specifically referencing Biden's foreign policy. He's talking about how Biden's been bombing Yemen during this war in Gaza. And what I found really interesting was how Donald Trump seems to be paying close attention to some of this rhetoric, because during his speech following the Supreme Court's ruling to allow him on primary ballots in states that try to disqualify him, he referenced the bombing in Yemen.
There are people coming from all parts of the Middle East. They're coming from Yemen, and yet you are bombing Yemen. You have to stop. You have to close the border. You have absolute authorization. You don't need Congress. I had the safest border in the history of our country.
So, Cenk, as we know, Donald Trump was not friendly to Muslims in his term. One of the first things that he did was attempt to ban Muslims from coming into the United States. That caused a huge controversy and multiple court battles. But I think it's also important to understand the perspective of that Yemeni American who sees Biden's foreign policy and kind of takes a step back and says, really, you think that Biden's a lot better than Trump on the treatment of Muslims or the treatment of Arabs?
Yeah, so first let's tackle the Muslim American perspective, and then I'll get to his general perspective in a second. So both for Bassem Youssef and the Trump supporter there, they're like, well, okay, so let's get this right. Obama did more drone strikes in Muslim countries than any president did, but I'm supposed to really like him. Okay, yes, maybe you like him, but I'm from Yemen and he did massive drone strikes in Yemen. And then, you know, and by the way, the US government allowed Saudi Arabia to pulverize Yemen. And yep. So, oh, because we wanted oil deals with Saudi Arabia. So then Biden gets into office and he lets the Israelis pulverize Gaza. So tell me why I have to support Biden. Because it helps you? Who does it help? It helps his donors. And maybe you think that it helps you, right? You liked one of the bills that he passed, or you don't like Trump. He's like, yes, but a lot of Arab Americans are saying, yes, but he killed my family members. So you're gonna kill my aunt and uncle and tell me I have to vote for you? I have to vote for you. I don't think you're getting it. And the reason why there's a disconnect is because in DC and in establishment Democrats and establishment media, there is this line of thought that the voters must vote for Democrats. And if they don't and the Democrats lose, it's the voters' fault.
And no matter what Democrats serve up, that's the part that really gets to me, right?
Yeah.
Because it's, hey, don't you dare bring up all of the different reasons why you are unhappy with the candidate or why you're unhappy with the Democratic policies. Doesn't matter. None of that matters. Orange man bad, very dangerous for the country. You absolutely must accept whatever we serve up in the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And look, most people don't operate that way.
Yeah, and they don't think that it is the responsibility of Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden or any of these guys to earn the votes.
Right.
They think, no, they're entitled to the votes. And how dare you oppose them by not voting for them when they're on our side? But whose side, brother? Whose side? If you live in Washington, D.C., yes, Biden is very much on your side. But if you're that guy, he's not on your side. Why? Look, I'm sorry, but if you live in D.C., are you thick? You have problems understanding? You kill someone's family member, they're not gonna vote for you. Is that complicated? Do I have to really emphasize that point? And I do, because they're like, it's his fault that Biden is losing. No, it's Biden's fault that Biden is losing. Such simple concepts. And they just can't grasp it, because it's an enormous sense of entitlement. I'm entitled to your vote and your vote and your vote. Even if I never do anything for you, even if I kill your family, I'm still entitled to your vote.
Look, the selling point for Biden, especially in 2020, when he claimed that he was only gonna run for that one term and be a transitional president, was that he is the decent human being in the race, right?
Yeah, well,
I'm the decent one. And yeah, you know, you might hate policies that he championed in his long political career, including the bankruptcy bill, the crime bill. I mean, the list goes on and on. But the whole point was, when you put him up against Donald Trump, you compare the two, go with the person who seems to be a decent human being, right? Comparatively speaking. Well, that argument falls apart when you see the bloodshed among civilians in Gaza. It's really hard to stomach that and still make the same argument that Biden is just a significantly more decent person than Donald Trump is.
Yeah, look, if you live in Washington, prepare to be outraged. I don't think Joe Biden's a decent person at all.
I can't accept anyone who argues that he is. How do you see those? Look, like I've said on the show before, like the hardest thing about talking about that story, about what's happening in Gaza, is the insult to injury, the reactions that you get from people after you've seen the faces of those malnourished children, after you see parents weeping over the dead bodies of their children. Like, how do you take in those images and then after that provide cover for the president, who insists on providing military aid and support to the government and the military carrying out those acts? How do you still support that guy? How do you do it?
So, I mean, Biden sees those same pictures. He has access to intelligence we don't even have access to. He sees all of this death, destruction, all those babies murdered, killed, and he goes, let's send them 14 billion more.
And then with a straight face, his supporters argue he's the good guy. He's the good guy.
He's not. So that
does, that's not to say that Trump is the good guy, but yeah, to argue that Biden is this angel and Donald Trump is a demon.
Yeah.
You know, he's indecent, he's awful, but Biden, what an angel. No, it's frustrating to hear that kind of framing when we see with our own two eyes what's happening right now.
So that's the second thing that's super frustrating, that people in Washington think in binary terms. I guess they're very slow, so us populists have to talk to them like they're children. Just because you think Joe Biden is a monster doesn't mean you think that Donald Trump is an angel. They could both be monsters. And there's such, you know why they create this binary world? Because they're not doing actual news, they're not being honest with you, they're doing propaganda. So that's why right-wing media will tell you that Trump's an angel and Biden's a devil, and mainstream media will tell you that Joe Biden is a sweet, empathetic man and Donald Trump is the devil, right? Everything is binary because they're not doing truth, they're doing propaganda. So now, last things here, back to this guy. He made an interesting point. So Trump is terrible on Muslim issues, arguably worse than Joe Biden. He tried to create a war in the Middle East several times, killing the top Iranian general, moving our embassy in Israel, etc. He wanted to ban all Muslims from the country. It doesn't get any worse than that in terms of Donald Trump. But the guy from Yemen, or his family is originally from Yemen, that Michael was talking to, he said in another part of that interview, which you should check out, by the way, youtube.com/theyoungturks. He said, you know, the thing about Trump though is he could be bought. Like he really likes the Saudis because the Saudis pay him off.
We actually have that clip. It's a short one. Why don't we watch that real quick?
Yeah.
He does say some crazy things, and for me, it doesn't bother me. Sometimes it's funny, but a lot of people, words matter to them. To me, it's your policy and what you're doing. You can say, I hate all you Muslims, this, this and that, whatever, and then you don't do the bad things, then to me, it doesn't matter. You're just talking, you just want a certain crowd to vote for you. That's cool. You know, it's all part of the game.
So you're not bothered when he says that he wants a ban on Muslims in this country?
No, because I don't think he actually believes that. He's very cool with the Saudis and the people in Abu Dhabi and stuff like that, and he's done a lot of business with them. So I think that's for a lot of his fan base that want that, because it sounds crazy. You can't ban a religion, you know?
No, I know, but I mean, you're aligning yourself with that fan base that do want that, that seriously do want that. So you're voting for, you know?
Well, there's always going to be different types of voters. So those people, no matter what he does, okay, let's say Trump did something really bad and bombed my country and was my home country, and you know, was, if he was actually doing stuff that I didn't like, I wouldn't want to vote for him.
So he's not like a hardcore MAGA guy. Clearly, he could be dissuaded from supporting Donald Trump, which I thought was interesting as well.
Yeah, although, quick point here, I've now begun to see some hardcore MAGA guys potentially including him, saying, yeah, I'm MAGA, I'm not necessarily just pro-Trump. And that's a distinction that I had never seen before. Mm-hmm. So that gives me a little bit of hope that the cult is cracking a little bit.
And also one point of clarification that's incredibly important. Remember, during Trump's term, there was a bipartisan resolution to pull US military support toward Saudi Arabia in its bombing of Yemen, and Donald Trump came in and vetoed it.
Yeah, so Donald Trump, I don't want anybody to mistake what we're saying. Yeah. Michael's right in that line of questioning. He associates with people who despise Muslims and wants to get their vote, and he caters to them, etc. And it doesn't appease me much that he's also corrupt and bought off by the Saudis. That doesn't appease me at all. And I think that Trump is just about as bad as it gets, not just generally, but specifically on this issue. And he also bought off by Sheldon Adelson in the last couple of elections. He's begging Miriam Adelson to get bribed by her to serve Israel's interests. Jared Kushner, seemed to be working both the Israelis and the Saudis, depending on who he's getting paid by, etc. So, look, it's a Hobson's choice. These are two terrible, terrible choices. Our point isn't that Trump is better on this issue. Our point is stop yelling at Arab and Muslim American voters
and
actually do something for them.
Yeah.
And the bar is so low. Like, could you please not fund a genocide? And if you can't clear that bar, then don't think that you're entitled to anyone's vote.
Totally agree. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to hear from some Republican voters and their thoughts on supporting candidates of a certain gender.